We'll proceed next in the matter of People v. Aida Sandoval, hearing first from Ms. Harris. Proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Donna Harris appearing on behalf of Aida Sandoval. May it please the Court. This case presents a completely unique set of facts. In this case, the jury completely rejected the prosecutor's theory of the case. And the exact factors that the Court used in aggravation were factors that were the entire theory of the prosecution's case. The prosecution's case was that Ms. Sandoval planned these murders. She premeditated these murders. She was the motivating force behind bringing these gangbangers with guns to the site to create the violence that resulted in these crimes without thinking about what the consequences would be, that her behavior was completely callous.
And your argument is premised upon the circumstance that there were charges of first-degree murder and the verdict was one of manslaughter.
That's correct. It was actually a specials case where they were charged with lying in wait, which was basically another one of the factors the trial court used in aggravation, that these people were ambushed without knowing, you know, from behind, not being armed, not knowing what was coming. And the jury completely rejected the prosecutor's theory of the case, completely rejecting all those factors in aggravation that were used by the court to make the findings in this case. For aggravation. This court cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that the constitutional error that occurred in this case did not contribute to the sentencing. And in light of the constitutional error, reversal is required in this case. And there is not a single one of the factors that the court can find that the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt because the jury completely rejected every one of those factors that the court used in aggravation. And in light of that, the court must remand resentencing because the court did find two mitigating factors. So the matter should be remanded to the court for the court to determine whether or not those mitigating factors justify imposition of the lower term as opposed to the presumptive middle term that was in place at the time of the sentencing. I'm not sure if the court wants me to address any other particular questions.
The time is yours to proceed as you wish, and we'll certainly pose any questions that occur to us.
Well, the prosecutor or the attorney general in this matter urged the court to reform the statute, much in the way that the Booker court reformed the federal guidelines, taking out the mandatory sentencing in the federal guidelines. In this matter, they're urging the court to take out the presumptive middle term. It appears that it would be completely contra to what the legislature's intent was at the time that they passed the determinate sentencing law. We went from a indeterminate sentencing law to where the court set up a specific pattern of determinate sentencing law specifically to limit judicial discretion.
Well, are you saying that this court either doesn't have the authority or even if it does have the authority, it should not exercise its authority to reform the statute? Or are you just saying we shouldn't reform it in a particular manner? What's your position?
My position is that this court does have the power to perform the reformation. But I don't think that it's necessary for this court. This court has more choices than the Booker court. Justice Breyer found that there were basically just two changes that the Supreme Court could make in terms of reformation of the federal guidelines, was do away with the entire system or do this reformation where we took out the mandatory language. And this court is not limited to that. Federal guidelines were set up in such a way that the Supreme Court felt that those were the only two options. This court has more options than that. I'm not saying that necessarily all the options are good, but the court does have more options than what was presented in Booker. This court could throw out the entire sentencing scheme.
If we were to do that, I think it would be safe to say that the legislature would not like that at all.
Well, like I said, I'm not saying that the court
shouldn't should we have. Consider in our resolution of the issue as to the choices of remedies, what would be absolutely, from the legislature standpoint, be something that it would consider wrong or impermissible? And the one you just mentioned, I think even without giving it a lot of thought, one would think that probably would not be or should not be the court's first choice, throwing out the entire sentencing law of California.
Well, I'm not advocating that. I agree with the court. That's not what the legislature would want.
So then,
I think what we're looking for is what would. Well, traditionally it was to reform to comply with what the court, what the legislature's intent was at the time that the law was originally enacted.
So we look to the intent of the prior legislature, not to this year's legislature, or not. What's your position?
Because the intent of the legislature at the time that they set up the law was what was important. What they were at that point in time doing was limiting judicial discretion. So I think we still need to keep that in mind if we're talking about reformation. But moving on, obviously the court's not going to throw out the entire sentencing scheme when there are other things that could be done that would more effectively keep what the legislature intended.
Should we take into account the current legislature's amendment to the determinate sentencing law?
I don't believe that that's the best option for the court.
Because?
Because we're, once again, you know, what the legislature, when they enacted the determinate sentencing law, they were trying to limit judicial discretion. By SB 40, the new law passed, has got a complete 180-degree turn from where we're limiting judicial discretion to opening up judicial discretion.
So is it your suggestion that prior legislature, because it wished to limit judicial discretion, would have preferred to create a right to jury trial on these factors?
I actually believe that would do the least violence to the sentencing scheme in California.
You believe that would be more consistent with the intent of the prior legislature than doing what the legislature this year decided to do?
Yes. By engrafting a jury trial on the aggravating factors, we basically maintain the sentencing scheme we have now, where in order to go above the presumptive middle term, I mean, the legislature set that presumptive middle term. They thought this was where most people would fall. This was the best sentence for all the majority of the people who commit this crime. This is where we start. We assume that everybody falls here unless you find those mitigating factors or you find those aggravating factors. If we engraft jury trials to establish a method for the court and for the juries to determine the aggravating terms, we're basically maintaining that system.
Do you think that the legislature would have concluded that jurors were adequately equipped to make determinations such as, for example, the defendant's offenses over the years have been of increasing seriousness, or there was unnecessary violence? Just to use as a hypothetical what I read about a Sacramento jury the other day struggling with that and their questions. Well, unnecessary. We don't know about other cases, so how can we say this was unnecessary violence? Do you think jurors were considered competent to make determinations like that by the prior legislature?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, part of what Justice Breyer had a problem with in grafting a jury trial requirement onto the federal guidelines was he thought it would complicate the system. We'd have to have these things where the jury has to make extra findings. And we already have that in California. We already trust our juries to make these extra findings, things where, like whether the bodily injury was great bodily injury.
Some, but not the ones I just gave you as examples. Not those, right?
Well, we don't have those yet, but there's no reason why we wouldn't. We entrust our juries to make all kinds of findings that are not necessarily easy.
So you're talking about the necessity then of a bifurcated proceeding. Obviously, we're not going to tell the jurors what the defendant's prior record has been. You wouldn't want that as a defense counsel. And I don't believe the legislature would have intended that. So you're saying that it would not do violence to the prior legislature's intent to not only fashion a process by which these things would be tried to a jury, but also to fashion a bifurcated process where we don't have that now.
Well, we do have a bifurcated process now. I mean, most of the things... gang allegations are sometimes bifurcated. Prior allegations are bifurcated. We have a system in place for juries to make many findings on enhancements.
But not the routine aggravating factors, certainly.
It depends on where you live. I mean, gang allegations are kind of a routine aggravating factor in L.A., whereas they might not be in some small jurisdiction. But if that's, you know, whether something is actually some, you know, a random person who stopped, well, I shouldn't say a random person, but a gang member who stopped in a parking lot and they find drugs on him, and it's alleged that he's performing this, you know, has the drugs for sale, and it's in, that the allegation is that he's doing it for the benefit of a gang. I mean, that's something not a common person, a common juror ever faces. How do they decide whether or not he's doing this for the benefit of a gang? It's just as vague as whether, you know, the crimes are of increasing seriousness.
How does the prosecutor determine what allegations to charge where these allegations or facts may unfold in the course of the trial? At least with the current system, the trial judge has the benefit of hindsight, but in terms of the prosecutor, he'd have to anticipate these aggravating factors. Some he can, but others wouldn't unfold until the trial had occurred. How would we deal with that?
Well, yeah. My experience in 20 years as a trial lawyer was that pretty much the prosecutor knows where their case is going. It never goes there. They've had the police officers to interview the witnesses. They often interview the witnesses themselves. They have a really good idea of what the aggravating factors are. And maybe they don't know whether they're going to be able to prove up everyone, but if they are interested in alleging that factor, if they're interested in using that factor, they will go ahead and charge that factor. And if it's not one that's proved, you know, if the jury finds it's not true, But since California already has a system in place where the juries are making many of these findings, many findings of enhancement, it wouldn't be any much more of a stretch for the juries to also be making findings on the aggravating factors.
All right, so what do we tell jurors? Ladies and gentlemen, you have to determine whether the defendant's priors are numerous and of increasing seriousness. Here's how you do that. What do we tell them?
Telling them these are what his prior crimes are. You have the same thing we tell them in everything else. You can't leave your common sense outside the door when you walk
into the courtroom. Oh, no. What kind of standards do we give them? Of course we know they can't leave their common sense outside the door and they can't be influenced by pity, passion, or public sentiment. We know all that. But when we say to them, you have to determine whether these are numerous and or of increasing seriousness, you do that by What?
By looking at what the charges were and determining whether you think that they're numerous and of increasing...
Well, should we tell them what numerous means, or should we just let each group of 12 figure out what qualifies as numerous?
I think you have to let each group of 12 qualify, determine whether they're numerous.
So in Kern County, two could be enough, and in some other county, it might require a dozen.
Yes. Depending on...
Well, there's an organized system.
But that's the way life is. The court's never going to be able to set up a bright line rule that two is considered numerous or that five is considered numerous.
All right. How about now that we've nailed that down, how about increasing seriousness? Do we tell the jury what the penalties are for the prior offenses?
I don't think it's necessary. I don't think the penalty necessarily, just the penalty, I don't think they need the penalty to determine whether they think robbery is more serious than vandalism.
Don't you think that the approach that you're suggesting would pose the counsel in another case a very good argument of denial of equal protection if there was such gross disparity in the way the laws were being applied in the state to persons similarly situated?
I'm not sure what the court said.
Let's just say that we have courts in some counties finding two is numerous and finding X is serious, and in another part of the state, even 10 isn't numerous and X is not serious. If you had, as you more or less described, the system of, I won't call it chaos, but it certainly sounds like it to me, but total disparity, total freedom from place to place to make these determinations, wouldn't there be a fairly good challenge on equal protection grounds by defense counsel that the system was not providing accessible, was not providing, you know, constitutionally required uniformity in the criminal justice system? Just
we don't have that now. We have Judge A in one county who might find that two or three priors is numerous, whereas another judge in L.A. who's seeing these, you know, people through the revolving door over and over and over again might find that somebody who has 8 or 9 or 10 priors and they're not particularly serious priors, that they're not numerous. We already have that.
Now, we do have some review on appeal of sentences that are grossly disproportionate. Wouldn't it be more difficult if we had to tell jurors that they are just free to make their own determinations as to seriousness and numerous counting of particular circumstances?
I don't see any reason why there would still not be review for the court finding insufficiency of the evidence.
That would be quite a workload added to appellate courts, too, wouldn't it? To have to review each one, each sentence, and say, well, this is numerous, this isn't, this is serious, this isn't. Much more than we have today.
I don't know why it would be much more serious, much more than we have today.
Well, you'd have lay jurors untrained in the law making those determinations based upon no practical experience on their part whether particular offenses were or were not of increasing seriousness or how, for instance, the violence inflicted in that case was unnecessary violence, which implies a comparison to other cases, which jurors are not privy to, unlike judges who are exposed to a broad spectrum of cases and take that into account in deciding what an appropriate sentence is in a given case.
I suppose the court could set up guidelines. There's nothing to prevent guidelines from saying, you know, I mean, for absolute uniformity, three is numerous or five is numerous.
All right, so then we tell the jury, you have to make a determination of whether or not he suffered these convictions, and then we're going to tell you that anything over three qualifies as numerous. So we're having a jury trial so that the jurors can do the math.
You may respond, and then your time is up.
I really think that most people, most jurors, have a lot of common sense. It's the same thing that we ask them in every jury trial, not to leave that common sense behind.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Harris. Mr. Maher.
May it please the Court. I wanted to first address the issue of reformation. Appellant's argument is that the legislative intent in 1977 was to actually limit judicial discretion. However, I don't believe that is a correct statement. Prior to 1977, certainly there was an indeterminate sentencing scheme. However, under that particular indeterminate sentencing scheme, it was actually the parole board, the adult authority, which had the true discretion to select a particular sentence. Under the pre-1977 system, basically the trial judge sentenced the defendant to the term prescribed by law, which oftentimes was simply a broad range of 1 year to an indeterminate life sentence. And then it was the parole board, the adult authority, which actually set the particular sentence. And so it was the parole board that actually had the discretion to set the sentence. So with the enactment of the DSL, it was actually a net gain in judicial discretion in determining the appropriate sentence. And it's the triad itself. It's the establishment of the triad itself which set the outer perimeters for judicial discretion.
So under the determinate sentencing law, then, based upon your argument that you're now making, the legislature gave trial courts substantial discretion in setting the appropriate term.
Correct. And the discretion would be to be exercised within the constraints of the lower term, middle term, and upper term. And any judicial reformation would, of course, be fully consistent with the establishment of the triad, because reformation would fix the Cunningham problem and would allow the trial courts the ability, the availability of the upper term in selecting the appropriate sentence.
Would it be correct to say that if we were to agree with the view you are urging this court to adopt, and accepting the view that you have articulated to the court, that under the determinate sentencing law, trial courts have substantial discretion, if we were to agree with you with respect to the proposed reformation, the discretion by the trial courts would be increased just slightly and presumably no problem?
Correct. It is only a slight increase in degree. As this court explained in Black in describing the DSL, the courts generally had broad discretion, and the statutory presumption contained in 1170 only constrained the discretion to some degree. So post-Reformation, there is a slight increase in discretion, but in practicality, very little. And it certainly would be consistent with the legislative intent to allow the trial courts that particular discretion. This court has asked counsel, what is the effect of Senate Bill 40 for purposes of determining the appropriate remedy? And it is our position that with the enactment of Senate Bill 40, the legislature has made the policy judgment that the way to fix Cunningham error is to remove the statutory presumption from 1170 and has rejected the alternative, which was either to just basically scrap the DSL in toto and eliminate the availability of the upper term in many cases, or to promulgate a jury trial system, which I believe this court's questions and answers have indicated would present some substantial difficulty for the trial courts to apply.
Of course, it would be nice and neat if there is a parallel between the legislature's prospective solution, and of course they are powerless to act retroactively on you, and what this court does retroactively. But are we not obligated to look at the legislature of 30 years ago rather than today's legislature in ascertaining what would be the legislative intent that should guide us in reforming the statute?
I believe it is correct that you will need to analyze what is the intent behind the enactment of the DSL back in 1977. Certainly that intent is a prerogative in determining reformation. As we have articulated, the proposed reformation would be fully consistent with that legislative intent in 1977. Certainly the 2007 legislative revisions to Section 1170 inform our analysis as to what the legislature would have preferred in 1977, because I think it's clear with the passage of Senate Bill 40 that the legislature intended to retain as much as possible of the DSL, but within the constraints of Cunningham. So Senate Bill 40 would certainly support the Attorney General's proposed reformation of Section 1170, so that the reformation would apply to those cases currently pending on appeal. In particular, it would basically apply to those cases, to those crimes in which the offense was committed before the effective date of Senate Bill 40, which is March 30, 2007.
So are you arguing that even though the determinate sentencing law was enacted way back in the 70s, nevertheless, it would be proper for this court to consider the actions of the current legislature in determining what the legislature way back in the 70s may or might have intended?
Well, Your Honor, the intent of the current legislature would not necessarily be fully determinative of determining what the 1977 legislature,
helpful, presumably.
But it certainly would be helpful because the intent of Senate Bill 40, again, was to retain as much as possible of the determinate sentencing law, but within the confines of Cunningham. Certainly they did not intend to set forth an alternative sentencing scheme, but it was merely an attempt to preserve the sentencing scheme within the constitutional constraints.
And retain the substantial discretion that the legislature back in the 70s already gave to the trial courts in California, right? We went through this question before.
Correct, Your Honor. I would agree with that.
Under the reformed system, judges pretty much have the same discretion, except that they don't have to make a finding. They can still pretty much do what they think is appropriate.
Correct. Correct. And, of course, it would be subject to appellate review for abuse of discretion, as many other and all other discretionary sentencing decisions are in California. This discretion that would be afforded to the trial court under a reform system certainly would not be unfettered and would be subject to appellate review. I'd also like to turn to the issue of harmless error in this case. As my colleague explained in the preceding argument in Black, one valid aggravating circumstance is sufficient to satisfy the Sixth Amendment, because that one particular aggravating circumstance would make the defendant eligible for the upper term, thereby making the upper term the statutory maximum.
What's the one we have here?
Well, we don't have a jury finding, and we don't have a fact that falls under the recidivism exception. However, my argument is that in looking at harmless error in this case, one aggravating circumstance that would have been found by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt is sufficient to satisfy the harmless error inquiry, because Cunningham error involves the absence of the trial court's authority to impose the upper term, and it does not extend to the discretionary selection.
So would have is enough? It doesn't have to be a factor that the jury did find, as in Black, but would have, or could have, or should have? Is any of that enough?
Well, would have, could have, or should have applies in this case, because unlike in Black, where there's no Cunningham error at all, there was Cunningham error in this particular case, in the selection of the upper term. So we are talking about the harmless error inquiry, which is a little different, and which is where we get into the would have, should have. The jury would have made the particular finding based upon uncontested or uncontradicted evidence.
Well, this is the problem I have looking at the trial court's reasons for its decision to impose the upper term. The judge said it's a crime involving a great amount of violence, incredibly callous behavior, no concern about the consequences of action, victims particularly vulnerable, motivating force behind the actions was the defendant, planning premeditation. And, of course, this is a case that was charged as first-degree murder and ended up being voluntary manslaughter. So isn't that a fairly massive rejection, not only of prosecution's case, except prosecution did get conviction, but certainly pretty massive rejection, at least of the prosecution's theory of the case, but also to a large extent a rejection, at least for purposes of Cunningham error, of the factors relied upon and expressed by the trial judge?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that there was some rejection of the prosecution's theory, since the prosecution did present a theory based on first-degree murder with special circumstances. So certainly the jury rejected that particular theory. The jury also, though, rejected the defendant's theory, which is that the crime was at most involuntary manslaughter, and that at best, in the defense perspective, that the defendant was guilty of no crime whatsoever. So I think it's fair to say on the basis of this record that the jury's verdict of voluntary manslaughter was certainly a compromise verdict. Now, turning to the particular aggravating circumstances in this case, the first one is the crime involved a great amount of violence. I don't believe the jury's finding as to voluntary manslaughter necessarily rejected or implicitly rejected that particular finding. It was uncontested that the victim of this particular count was shot four times and that he suffered two gunshot wounds to the head, including one contact wound in which the muzzle was placed against the defendant's skull. It was uncontradicted and uncontested that that is what's occurred. The jury, had it been presented with this allegation, would have found that circumstance true, especially because in this particular circumstance, it doesn't involve necessarily the defendant's direct responsibility in having directly perpetrated that violence. The factor was focusing on the particular circumstances of the crime committed, the type of violence committed against this particular defendant.
Just for clarification, I gather that the crimes themselves involved great violence. Is it further correct to observe that the defendant herself was not engaged in committing the great violence?
It is correct that the defendant was not the direct perpetrator of the violence. She was prosecuted under an aiding and abetting theory. So the prosecution, under this aiding and abetting theory, the prosecution presented two alternative theories: that she directly shared the direct perpetrator's intent, which was first-degree murder, or at least that she planned some type of violent confrontation with the people who had beaten her up a couple days earlier. And under the natural and probable consequences doctrine of aiding and abetting liability, the killings were a natural result of that particular target crime.
But to go back to what the Chief Justice, I think, articulated on the issue of harmless error, I think the Chief pointed out that here the jury came back with, voluntary manslaughter rather than murder?
Correct.
And then in and I think the Chief mentioned the trial court's reliance on the defendant's callousness, planning and premed, etc., etc. But I presume it could be pointed out that these particular issues were hotly contested at the trial level, and as the Chief pointed out, it led to a lesser verdict on the issue of guilt by the jury. Given that circumstance and the circumstance of the violence that you and I talked about, it also seems there is something else that I think the court, our court here, would properly consider, the trial court found that the victims were particularly vulnerable. But that, too, at least in my view, was a subject open to dispute. The victims were not very young, very old, or any way infirm. And I gather the defendant herself told the police that she believed some of the bar patrons were armed. So it would appear that given the various circumstances that the chief earlier and that I now have also articulated, one could reasonably come to the conclusion that this court cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that the violations of defendant's right to a jury trial was harmless. If we were to come to that conclusion, I presume then we take a look at the option of remand?
That would be correct. If this court found that the error in this case was prejudicial, the next logical step would be, what should we do with this case? And what do we do when we remand back to the lower courts? And that would place judicial reformation of Section 1170 squarely into play. Also, Your Honor, I would like to address the question of the aggravating circumstance of particular vulnerability. Certainly, the victim in this particular case may have not been particularly young or particularly old, but he was vulnerable in the sense that he was not a participant in the prior violence that involved the appellant. He was simply an innocent bar patron attempting to leave. He certainly had no expectation that he would be taken by surprise and shot at multiple times. He was clearly, by all accounts, an innocent bystander and a classic victim of mistaken identity. So in those particular circumstances, it would be our position that this victim in this particular case was certainly particularly vulnerable. Also, with respect to the jury's actual verdict, as I mentioned previously, there was many aspects, many indications that there was a compromise verdict in this case. For example, the jury rejected the allegation that a principal in the offense was armed. As the trial court noted at the sentencing hearing, that finding was simply factually and legally impossible because it was uncontested that the victims were killed by firearms. And the jury necessarily found that appellant was an aider and abettor to the direct perpetrator. So the jury's actual findings in this case may be of more limited utility. In determining harmless error, as the U.S. Supreme Court set forth and explained in the case of Nieder versus United States, in determining the harmless error as to the absence of a particular jury finding, you have to look at what a rational jury would have done based upon the record in the particular case. And I believe in this case, a rational jury certainly would have found that the killings in this case involved grave violence and certainly that the victim in this case was particularly vulnerable. So it would be our position under that legal reasoning process that the error in this case was harmless. If this court has no further questions, I would be prepared to submit.
Thank you, Mr. Maher. Ms. Harris, you may argue in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's clear from the jury's verdict in this case that they had a great deal of difficulty finding what Ms. Sandoval's level of culpability was. The prosecutor's theory, basically, from start to finish, was that she was the motivating force behind this. She was the one who planned this and picked up these people with guns, took them to this bar in retaliation. That was his whole theory of the case. Only as a fallback position did he say, well, if you can't do that, then maybe you could find natural and probable consequences. That she, if you believe her, then she wanted to go confront this guy and as a natural and probable consequence of any assault, who ended up dead. And even under that theory, he was arguing first-degree murder. He never fell back from that position. He never argued second. He never argued that, well, under this theory you could find voluntary, under this theory you could find involuntary.
It would be almost impossible to conjure up a natural and probable consequences analysis that would lead to a voluntary, wouldn't it? I mean, aiding and abetting to go to the bar to fight, to settle the score, and it's naturally and probably foreseeable that someone will act in the heat of passion. Wouldn't that have to be the scenario in order legally to get to voluntary manslaughter?
Yes, but there's no intent to kill, but it's natural and probable consequence that violence could happen. Somebody could get killed.
Well, I guess my observation is that, wouldn't you agree that this pretty much does look like a compromise verdict? That when you really subject it to rigorous legal analysis, it's hard to articulate just how you would get there by applying the natural and probable consequences theory to what an aider and abettor might anticipate another principal might do by way of becoming so irrational that they'd act in a murderous way. That would be a hard argument to make, don't you think?
It would be harder to make, but it is kind of what the whole natural goal and probable consequences really is.
Okay.
You don't intend the result, but it is a natural and probable consequence that somebody could become enraged, somebody could act out of passion and hurt someone. But my argument is that the prosecutor's theory from start to finish was first-degree murder. He never backed down from that. Even when they were discussing jury instructions, he scoffed at the thought that they could possibly come back with a voluntary manslaughter, or that they could possibly come back involuntary on either Ms. Sandoval or her co-defendant. And yet that's exactly what happened. They had a really, really difficult time with finding that she was responsible. And in their rejection of the prosecutor's first-degree murder theory, they rejected that. She was the one who was totally responsible for bringing all this violence. That she was the one who premeditated, planned, was the motivating force behind this. And even as far as whether the person was vulnerable, whether the victims were vulnerable, that was part of the lying in wait special allegation that was in this case. Why they were vulnerable was because somebody's lying in wait and ambushes them. And the jury rejected the theory that she was responsible for that. They rejected the theory she was responsible for these people using guns.
All right, so what, from your perspective, what should we do with regard to a potential remand?
I absolutely believe the court must remand because you cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that the constitutional error did not contribute to this.
Right. And when we remand, what do we say?
I believe the court needs to direct the court to resentence without any aggravating factors. And because the court found mitigating factors, the court must decide whether to impose the lower term or the middle term.
So you're saying that the option of an upper term is not open to the trial judge on remand? No matter what might be presented to it by parties?
Well, unless there's a jury finding of aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, the court can't consider, the trial court cannot consider those to impose the aggravating factors.
So the only route open is the plead and prove to a jury route as opposed to a discretionary finding by a trial court on remand without the necessity of findings by the judge. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe that to remand would allow the court to make those findings, you know, the basic reformation that was done by the legislature would bring forth an ex post facto. Ex post facto problem, because you're basically increasing her liability beyond the presumptive middle term that was in place at the time that she was committed her crime and was sentenced.
Well, couldn't you say the same thing about engrafting a jury trial requirement. You know, my impression is that in some counties, defense counsel are very eager to have jurors make those determinations. But my equally strong impression is there's some counties that don't want jurors getting anywhere near this and would much rather have judges do this. Now, of course, you can say, well, defense counsel would waive jury trial in those counties, but the prosecution might not. They might like, just to pick an example out of the thin air, to have a Kern County jury make that determination. They might feel they'd get an upper term every time. How do you feel about that?
I don't have any problem with having a jury trial on everything. I mean, that happens now with enhancements. There are some enhancements, particularly with the gang enhancements, where the prosecutor insists that they will not waive jury. The court has no further questions. I'm prepared.
Thank you, Ms. Harris.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maher. The matter stands submitted, and we are in recess until 1 o'clock.